Putin's nomination as Prime Minister in August 1999 confirms that he has been approved of by the whole family, but he's still unknown to the population.
No one knew him. Everyone was asking, who is this Putin man? Do you remember that question? Who is Mr. Putin? So he had to show who he was. And that's when we had the explosions in the Moscow apartment blocks.
In 3 weeks, explosions in several Russian towns kill 300 people. The government immediately accuses the Chechen rebels. But when another explosion is nipped in the bud and two terrorists are arrested, the Kremlin surprisingly orders the police to stop inquiries. Journalists discover what could well become a state affair. The terrorists in question are in fact members of the FSB. NTV, the TV station belonging to Vladimir Gusinsky, broadcasts a debate on the implication of the FSB in the explosions, where FSB officials accuse one another of collusion. The public still finds this hard to believe. But journalists are pursuing their investigations. And as Prime Minister, Putin realizes that there is no time to be lost. He must create a diversion. He decides to exploit the population's hatred for the Chechens.
You see, Chechnya has always been the politician's grave. A lot of people were afraid and thought Putin should keep his distance. But he was determined. To general surprise, it played in his favor. The middle class became angry. Putin reacted in the same way. This is when he started to build his image, saying, I'm a man like you. I'm the head of state, but I'm the same as you.
Мы будем преследовать террористов везде, в аэропорту. Значит, вы уж меня извините, в туалете поймаем, мы и в сортире их замочим, в конце концов. Все, вопрос закрыт окончательно.
Я думаю, Путин становится...
It's at this moment that Putin really becomes Putin. He acquires his own language, freedom of expression, and complicity with the Russian people. He's no longer afraid of his public.
For the last three centuries, many Russians and their leaders have resented the Chechen bandits, as they call them. The Chechens have always refused to submit to Russian dominance. Stalin deported them by thousands. Yeltsin's peace treaty is felt as a humiliation, and for the population, the recent explosions are a provocation. Their Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin, is entirely justified in declaring a new war. Berezovsky asks Sergei Dorienko, the star journalist of his TV station, to put his political news magazine at the service of Vladimir Putin.
He
often asked me in private to provoke a situation. For example, when I suggested that our army attack Chechnya, he said, say it on the air. I said, I was going to anyway, you say it. He answered, no, I want you to say it for me. We'll see how people react.
On the 1st of October, Russian bombers attack Grozny, the capital of Chechnya. With Berezovsky's state TV and the population behind him, Putin throws Russia into a ferocious war. The Chechen people are the victims of unprecedented barbarity.
Putin showed that he was capable of making a firm political stand and of taking difficult political decisions. He showed that he was the ideal military leader for the country.
That was an extract from Jean-Michel Carr and Gilles Emery's disturbing film from 2007, The Putin System. It's a very thought-provoking watch, but on one point I would correct it. That clip suggests that the war on Chechnya was kind of an afterthought tagged onto the end of the apartment bombings, which doesn't quite fit with a bunch of evidence that I found online, even in Wikipedia, underneath a lot of less convincing stuff. For example, an article in Svenska Dagbladet just 3 months before reported Kremlin leaders were considering, quote, a series of terror bombings in Moscow that could be blamed on the Chechens, unquote. A month later, on the 22nd of July, the Moscow newspaper Moskovskaya Pravda published leaked documents about an operation Storm in Moscow, which, by organizing terrorist acts, would cause chaos, bring about a state of emergency, thus saving Yeltsin's regime. Duma member Konstantin Borovoy said prior to the blasts that he had been, quote, warned by an agent of Russian military intelligence of a wave of terrorist bombings, unquote. A lot of bombs were found and diffused in Moscow in September. The ones that went off were in Bunaksk on the 4th of September, two in Moscow on the 9th and the 13th, and Volgodonsk on the 16th of September. In a bizarre echo of the premonition that World Trade Center 7 was going to collapse before it actually did, on the 13th of September, this is the second bombing, just hours after that had gone off, the Russian parliamentary speaker Gennady Seleznyov of the Communist Party was handed a note by an FSB officer and made an announcement to the Duma. Quote, I have just received a report. According to information from Rostov-on-Don, an apartment building in the city of Volgodonsk was blown up last night. Unquote. But that was the second one, which was in Moscow. The Volgodonsk bombing didn't occur until 3 days later. When it did occur, Vladimir Zhirinovsky demanded an explanation in the Duma, but instead of replying, Seleznev turned his microphone off. 2 years later, in an interview in March 2002, Seleznev stated by way of explanation that he was referring to an unrelated hand grenade-based explosion which did happen in Volgodonsk, but which didn't kill anybody or destroy any buildings. So he still not explained why he announced that an apartment building was blown up when he was actually just talking about a hand grenade going off, and he didn't explain why he bothered to tell anybody in Parliament about a hand grenade going off. I find myself easily convinced by FSB defector Alexander Litvinenko, who described it as a typical bureaucratic mess-up, quote, Moscow too was on the 13th and Volgodonsk was on the 16th, but they got the message to the speaker the other way round, unquote. Then, of course, there's the incident in Ryazan, which was the last of the bombings. I've done a little bit of research, and this is some of the stuff that I've turned up, mainly from Wikipedia. At 8:30 p.m. on the 22nd of September, 1999, a resident of an apartment building in the city of Ryazan noticed two suspicious men who carried sacks into the basement of an apartment block from a car with a Moscow license plate. He alerted the police, but by the time they arrived, the car and the men were gone. The policemen searched the building, found 3 50-kilo sacks of white powder in the basement, attached to a detonator and a timing device, which were armed and set to go off at 5:30 the next morning. Yuri Tkachkino, head of the local bomb squad, was called. He disconnected the detonator and the timer, tested the 3 sacks of a white substance with a gas analyzer. The device detected traces of a military explosive used in the previous bombings. The Moscow FSB later suggested that it was a mock bomb and the bags contained only sugar, but Tkachkenko said that the explosives, timer, power source, and detonator were all genuine military equipment and had obviously been prepared by an expert. The gas analyzer, he said, tested the vapors coming from the sacks and unmistakably identified the presence of an explosive. Tkachkenko said that it was out of the question that the analyzer could have malfunctioned, as it was of world-class quality, cost $20,000, and was maintained by a specialist who worked according to a strict schedule, checking the analyzer after each use and making frequent checks. He pointed out that since his life depended on the gas analyzer, He knew that it was maintained with meticulous care. Police officers who answered the original call also confirmed the authenticity of the bomb and insisted the substance in the bomb was obviously not sugar, as was later claimed by the Moscow FSB. Police and rescue vehicles converged from different parts of the city. 30,000 residents were evacuated from the area. 1,200 local police officers, armed with automatic weapons, set up roadblocks on highways around the city and started patrolling railway stations and airports to hunt down the terrorists. Composite sketches of the three suspected terrorists, two men and a woman, were posted everywhere in the city and shown on television. At 8 a.m. the next morning, Russian television reported the attempt to blow up the building in Ryazan. Later that evening, a telephone service employee in Ryazan tapped into a long-distance phone conversation and heard somebody from out of town advising the others to, quote, split up and make your own way out, unquote. That person's number was traced to an exchange unit serving FSB offices. Three people were arrested. On their arrest, they produced FSB identification cards and were hastily released on orders from Moscow. That same day, leaving nothing to chance, Putin announced that Russian warplanes were bombarding Grozny's airport as the first stage of a planned war in Chechnya. Now, you might be wondering what the FSB could do in the light of so much evidence pointing towards their complicity in the Ryazan attack. And the answer seems to be fairly standard in this case, the big lie. On the 24th of September, the FSB director Nikolai Patrushev announced that Ryazan was an exercise to test the responses after earlier blasts. The local FSB in Ryazan were extremely angry and issued a statement saying, quote, "This announcement came as a surprise to us and appeared at the moment when the FSB had identified the places of residence in Ryazan of those involved in planting the explosive device and was preparing to detain them," unquote. The Russian Duma rejected a motion for parliamentary investigation of the Ryazan incident. And that was clearly supposed to be an end to the matter, but unconvinced by the official line, the Russian people organized a public commission to investigate the bombings, headed by Sergei Kovalev, a respected human rights activist and a deputy in the Duma. He asked lawyer Mikhail Trepashkin to investigate the case. Trepashkin gathered various pieces of evidence, but we don't know exactly what, because he was unable to bring his evidence to court, since a few days before he was due to make his findings public in October 2003, he was arrested for disclosing state secrets. In a letter from prison, he alleged the year before that the FSB had already decided to kill Alexander Litvinenko, and the FSB people had promised not to send him to jail if he left the public commission and started working for them against Litvinenko. Trepashkin's work did at least establish that the basement of the Ryazan building in which the bombs were found was rented by an FSB officer who was witnessed there by many people. The FSB officer in question, Vladimir Ivanovich, could not be questioned further because he'd been killed later in a hit-and-run accident. The conclusion of the public commission, of which at least two members have subsequently been assassinated, summarized by Kovalev saying, quote, "What can I tell? We can prove only one thing. There was no training exercise in the city of Ryazan, and authorities do not want to answer any questions about this," unquote. In the light of the public commission's findings, the Duma had another vote on the Ryazan incident, and on a pro-Kremlin party-line vote, they voted to declare the matter an official secret, to seal all materials related to the Ryazan incident for the next 75 years, and forbid any further investigation into what happened. Now, I've been selective in my reading of the facts. There's a few more, of course. If you look at the Wikipedia page, it looks quite unclear what's going on. And, for example, the chap who defused the bomb originally, the head of the local bomb squad, who was so sure that it was a bomb earlier in 1999, 2 years later contradicted his earlier statement, said his diagnosis of the bomb was in error, that there wasn't an explosive, in fact he hadn't even used a gas analyzer, that he misidentified the military-grade detonator that it was in fact a hunting cartridge that could never have worked. Now, if you are new to the September 1999 bombings, another film I would recommend is Rebellion, the Litvinenko case. It's largely in Russian with English subtitles, which is why it wouldn't work for this show, but it tells the story of Alexander Litvinenko, who was an FSB insider who, with a small cadre of friends, stood up to what they considered immoral orders given by their FSB bosses. Now, he was murdered by polonium, which the FSB, formerly the KGB, has a record of using on people it dislikes. Now, Wikipedia would have us believe there's still a matter of controversy about who was ordering the attacks, but in all my investigations, I have not uncovered a shred of evidence that it was carried out by the Chechens, the party whom the Russian government fingered from day one. So the conclusion that it was a false flag seems like a safe one. Note that, in spite of the complete lack of evidence advanced, the Russian populace got behind the idea that it was Chechen terrorists, thus playing into the hands of those who sought war in Chechnya. But I venture to suggest, 10 years on, the Russian people would not be so easily fooled. With a lot more people aware of what is a false flag attack, September the 11th, at least outside of corporate America, widely recognized for what it is, the question still remains, well, what do we do about it? But the possibility for deception is, I think, diminished with a populace who understand that the wars of the future are not wars between nations, but between an elite which would dominate us all and a mass of populace who, by and large, are not ready for this to happen. Now, moving from history to actuality, this is from 2010, a report on goings-on in Iraq, which was broadcast in the UK by BCFM, Bristol Community Local Radio, and the whole show, of course, is available for download from our website, but it was originally posted at radioforall.net.
Another massive bomb on Tuesday this week has killed 60 Iraqis and injured many more. Here is the report on that that came out this week from the Associated Press, at least a little brief summary of it. Powerful blasts targeting security forces struck where they are supposed to be the safest, turning police stations into rubble and bringing down concrete walls erected to protect them from insurgents. Where is the protection? Where are the security troops? Said Abdu Mohammed, an eyewitness to a car bombing near Baghdad's Aidan Square that killed two passers-by as well. What is going on in this country? Iraq's foreign minister said insurgents are attempting to sow as much chaos as possible as lawmakers struggle to form a new government and Americans withdraw troops. And Iraqi leaders have failed to end the political impasse. Nobody immediately claimed responsibility for this particular blast, but they bore the hallmark, apparently, of Al-Qaeda. So, yet another massive bomb attack with scores of innocent Iraqis blown to pieces has taken place this week. It seems that these bombs are exploding more frequently now. The US Army has been replaced with various private military companies such as Blackwater's mercenaries. So, rather than the US troops being withdrawn, they've simply been replaced by private mercenary soldiers. The so-called private military companies are a very sensitive issue, it seems. One whistleblower from a PMC, as they're called, was announced at 10 a.m. in the beginning of a BBC Radio 5 Live's Victoria Derbyshire programme about 3 months ago, a whistleblower from a private military company. Although the item was announced at the start of the show, the whistleblower never actually appeared on the programme and no explanation was given. Indeed, no further mention was made of the item, and it was as if it had never existed at all. Anyway, Bristol is very lucky to have half based here Sami Valiola, who founded the Humanitarian Liaison Centre in Kirkuk, Iraq. I say half-based here because Sami is half-Bristolian and half-Iraqi. I spoke to Sami about his role there in Kirkuk, where he approaches the US military on behalf of families where members of the family have simply disappeared. In other words, they may have been arrested or killed, but the family know nothing about them, and Sami attempts to locate them where possible, get them released from arbitrary arrest. Anyway, back to the big bombs, and it does seem extremely strange that Iraqis should be blowing up their own people in a futile attempt to fight the occupation. So if Iraqis are not planting these massive bombs, who is? The rumours which are constantly circulating in Iraq, which are very rarely heard over here, are that rather than squabbling Iraqi groups planting them, the occupying mercenaries are planting them, and then using the world media through official announcements and agencies like Associated Press and Reuters to blame them on insurgents or rival internal groups sometimes. There's also a strong possibility that suicide bombers may not be suicide bombers at all, simply innocent people who've had explosives planted on them by the occupation forces. Anyway, we're going to break that particular taboo tonight as we hear Sami Valiola tell one story he was told on fear of the witness's life, and also one incident that Sami experienced himself.
My name is Sami Valiola. I have founded the organization of Humanitarian Liaison Center in Kirkuk, Iraq. I went to Iraq taking medical aid and medicine in two trips. I'm Iraqi-British, from Iraqi background. I've lived about 50% of my life in Iraq and the other 50% in Britain. And when they were determined to start the war in Iraq, supposedly to liberate Iraq from Saddam's regime, as they say, I knew something horrible going to happen. I knew there will be a lot of casualties over there, and people are going to need some help. And I thought instinctively, like, to go with a group of friends that they are helping me in Bristol to go and collect aid and medicine. And one of the guys who came to me forward, like, he came forward to me to say, "Look, I'm ready to speak to you, but if you want, if you can get somebody to give you immunity to take me abroad, and I live there. I take a refuge there somewhere, because if this word gets out here, they kill me." He was working in the first mobile communication company, SSL, in Iraq. He works, let's say, the distance between Bristol and Bath. He works in a city just outside Kirkuk. He's a driver. He takes the people into work, and after hours, you bring them back into Kirkuk. The U.S. Army convoy of them, they stopped this about 10 cars on the way. They got the people out of the cars about 100 meters away, told them to keep their way away, their face away from the car, from their vehicles, while they carry out a search. So they sat down with their hands up, searched their vehicles, and then after about 10 minutes they said to them, "Right, it's nothing, 10-15 minutes, you can go back to your cars, you're clear to go." Then what happened is, this is a minibus. The guys went back to the vehicles, and the driver went to drive the car. One of the passengers said, "Well, my seat is not right. It's moving a bit. Can you straighten it or something?" He came down, and he's looking at the seat, which is not like pushed down properly, one of those lifting seats. And he lifted the seat. Loads of explosives underneath the seat. And he's like, "What's happening?" They came to search their vehicles, and after that, the explosives inside the car. So they take off, and they dump, there's a river further down the road, they dump the explosives there, and he's scared for his life. He thinks those people, they'll be transported from the branch to the headquarters of the communication. So this vehicle would have been in that destination. When he arrives there, they would have triggered and blew it up. And the other incident was a police lieutenant. I was in that area, a specific area, that people, there's a petrol station further ahead, and those people, they are refusing to join the queue. They're trying to cheat. The Americans, they've taken about six or seven cars in a convoy. Hummers behind and Hummers ahead. And they're going, supposedly they are committed offense, and they're going to trying to put them straight, you know. So they come to this area where I was in. One of the vehicles breaks down, and the American soldier gets out with the driver. they push this vehicle to the roadside, and that road is a very busy road. They don't allow vehicles to stop there unless they know the owner where it is and if he's got a shop there or something like that. So not long after that, the police, they came, Iraqi police. Who's the owner of this car? Who's the owner of this car? Nobody can find the owner. So immediately they try to break the window of the car to search it. I came to the lieutenant, I said to him, I said, listen, officer, I said, the guy, the driver, has been taken by the Americans, so no need to smash or vandalize. Obviously the car broke down, I saw that, and they had taken the driver. I said, listen, my brother, I'm not trying to be horrible, but let me tell you something. Do you think the Americans are trustworthy? How would I know? They haven't agreed with this guy, or they've taken him somewhere else and they booby-trapped his car and they brought him here. I can't trust that. He called the headquarters. He said, this is my patch, this area. I do not want this vehicle, whether the Americans, whether the Israelis, anybody. I don't care whether the Iraqi government. I don't care. This car will be lifted from there, take it somewhere else. I have no trust in no Americans, no one. I only trust my instinct. This car was dumped. I don't know what they've done to the car. When it explodes, it's my responsibility.
Now, there was a famous incident where the British actually went in and took some SAS people, what was believed to be SAS people, who had been arrested by the Iraqi police. Do you know anything about that incident? Because I think we remember it was over a couple of days in the news here. It was a very strange thing because first of all, the Iraqi police arrested them, mm-hmm. And then the British then came and actually attacked a house where he was being kept, smashed through the wall, and got these people out. So what was all that about? What can you explain?
Because there was a roadblock by the police, and this dressed in civilian SAS workers or soldiers, they tried to push their way. The Iraqi police open fire. Not only they're civilians, so they don't have something written on their forehead or something. Oh, we're agents or we're working with the British Army. So they open fire on them. When they stopped, they've tried to clear their way to say, open the road for us. And I don't know what means and what they communicated with them. But when they refused, the Iraqi assault or Iraqi police, they refused. They opened fire and killed one of them, I think, at least. And then they shut off in their vehicles. Their vehicles are off-road vehicles as well, so they can take over any obstacles on the way. So they took off. Eventually, the Iraqi police caught up with them and arrested them, because of number of them, obviously. They took them to a prison in Basra, where British Army, that night, they decided they're going to drive the tank, reverse into the police station and free them from the cells.
That was Sami Veliola, Bristolian from the Humanitarian Liaison Centre in Kirkuk, Iraq.
Just to reiterate this point, because I don't think it's very widely understood just what is going on this occasion, two UK soldiers were travelling around in plain clothes and, according to the Iraqis, shooting people. I think they were wearing fake beards. The UK Ministry of Defence refused to confirm whether they were operating undercover or not. They were arrested after a car chase, put in prison. The UK government immediately made formal representations to have them handed over. The Iraqis denied to hand them over. The UK then, on the subsequent day, broke into the police station where it thought they were being held. They'd been transferred to a jail. Over a dozen vehicles, including helicopters and tanks, were used to break into the prison where they were being held. I'm quoting here a BBC report from September 2005 on John Reid. This is UK Defence Secretary. Headline: Reid, right to mount rescue mission. British forces have rescued two UK servicemen who were arrested by Iraqi police in the southern city of Basra. It quotes Dr. Reid as saying, "We should never give in to violence." That presumably doesn't include breaking down a prison wall with helicopters and tanks. Instead, that's called a daring rescue. And the article concludes with some reassurance from a statement by the UK Defence Secretary, quote, "We remain committed to helping the Iraqi government for as long as they judge the coalition presence is necessary to provide security," unquote. Colonel Tim Collins, former commander of British troops in Iraq, who likened Basra unrest to a busy night in Belfast, said it didn't represent breakdown of law and order in Basra, which was still a safer city than Baghdad. Well, I haven't checked the news from Northern Ireland recently, but I rather think if an invading power sent people in plain clothes to pretend to be insurgents and went around shooting people, then broke into a police station and sent tanks and helicopters to break down the walls of a prison, then I probably would have heard about it. So I think that's a strange parallel to talk about that as being a busy night in Belfast. And the last sentence of the article, that Basra was at least safer than Baghdad, may in fact be true, but doesn't reflect terribly well on the democracy and peace which somebody one day, a long time ago, talked about bringing to Iraq. So I hope that has assisted you in reading between the lines, understanding what you're being told and what you're not being told and why. And now let's move on to another story that was cooked up and served ready in time for some reenactment of anti-terror laws, this one from 2009. I haven't looked into it in great detail, but it seems all too familiar. This is the so-called underwear bomber, and this segment is from Kenneth Doust's New World Notes show from a couple of weeks ago.
Let's have an update on the big Christmas story of last year, the underwear bomber. Whatever happened to that guy? Well, here's what I've pieced together from various news sources. In September 2010, a federal court in Detroit granted the request of Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab, a young man who is a citizen of Nigeria, to fire his four lawyers and represent himself in court. Abdulmutallab is accused of attempting to use explosives hidden in his underwear to blow up a commercial airliner flying from Amsterdam to Detroit on Christmas Day 2009. Nothing suspicious so far, right? Obviously, a 24-year-old foreign national who knows nothing about U.S. law should be allowed to represent himself in a terrorism case that could result in his execution or at least imprisonment for life. A standby counsel named Anthony Chambers was appointed to advise Abdulmutallab during his self-defense. In a hearing in October 2010, Abdulmutallab petitioned the court not to allow standby counsel Chambers to see any of the prosecution's evidence against him. Okay, nothing suspicious here either, right? The petition was denied by U.S. District Court Judge Nancy Edmonds. She ruled that his legal advisor needed to see the state's evidence against Abdulmutallab. But Abdulmutallab is still being allowed to defend himself. Abdulmutallab is being held at a federal prison in Milan, Michigan. The judge set the next hearing for January 12. Now let's go back to 2009. I'm going to replay John Stewart's fine take on the incident from January 2010, but let me fill in some background. I think you'll agree that this is not just a false flag operation, but a false flag operation of such staggering ineptitude that we should demand our money back. October 2009. Mr. Abdulmutallab, a Nigerian banker, supposedly is worried that his son Umar was being converted to radical Islam. Does he ask the local assistant imam to give the kid some spiritual counseling? No. Instead, Dad reports his son to the U.S. State Department. On to a terrorist watch list goes young Umar. Nothing suspicious so far, right? Now, the rest takes place just before Congress is scheduled to vote on renewing certain repressive sections of the Patriot Act. Christmas Day 2009. Young Umar goes to the Lagos airport and buys a one-way ticket to Detroit via Amsterdam. He's on a terrorist watch list. He pays cash for the ticket. He has no bag. He has no coat. He has no passport. They let him board the flight anyway. Do you sense some official collusion here? He changes planes in Amsterdam. A mysterious man, apparently from India, accompanies Umar to the check-in desk. Umar is on a terrorist watch list. He has no bags. He has no coat. He has no passport. And in Amsterdam, they let him board the flight anyway. In midair, Umar prepares to blow the plane out of the sky. He goes to the lavatory and locks the door. With a syringe, he squirts acid onto the PETN explosive in his underpants. Does he press himself against the fuselage, channeling the blast outwards through it? Of course not. He leaves the lavatory. Whatever is in his pants ignites while he's in the aisle. His pants start smoking. Other passengers wrestle him to the ground. Does a flight attendant then come over with a fire extinguisher? They didn't tell us that part. A year later, millions of dollars worth of full-body scanners have been sold to the TSA to prevent near tragedies like this one from ever happening again. Now ask yourself, given this absurd cock-and-bull story, do you believe that Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was a real terrorist seriously attempting to blow up an airliner? Or was this a Punch and Judy show, aided by the security services of Nigeria, the Netherlands, and the United States, designed to ensure renewal of the Patriot Act and to sell full-body scanners? How preposterous does an official story have to be before Americans say, "I don't believe it"? Remember the two teenagers who were charged with attempting to take over the Army base, Fort Dix? They didn't have a plan, and they didn't have even a gun. Not one gun. All they had was an enthusiastic friend egging them on. The friend turned out to be an FBI informer. They were going to capture an army base. The two of them. They were convicted, by the way. That was an earlier case of terrorism hysteria. But for sheer, absurd improbability, the underwear bomber scam of last Christmas is hard to top. Now here's John Stewart's take on it.
So what are the Al-Qaeda masterminds of terror 2.0 cook up?
Federal investigators say the man accused of the attempted bombing, Umar Abdulmutallab, hid a powerful explosive powder in specially made underwear.
So even if the bomb works, there's going to be 72 very disappointed virgins. Now, whenever there's an incident like this, the question is always, could we have seen it coming? But in this case, a Nigerian guy from Yemen with doomsday underpants? It seems to come out of nowhere.
As early as August of 2009, the Central Intelligence Agency was picking up information on a person of interest dubbed a Nigerian.
The suspect already on a U.S. terror watch list.
Put there after his father, a Nigerian banker, told the U.S. 5 weeks ago that he was worried his son was becoming radicalized.
Okay, all right, I too have a tendency to ignore messages from Nigerian bankers who wish to help me. But when they show up in person and aren't asking for a money order, but instead turning in their own son, maybe that conversation doesn't get filed under spam.
His visa had been yanked by the British. He paid cash for his ticket.
Yeah.
It was a one-way ticket.
He paid nearly $3,000 in cash for his plane ticket and checked no bags.
What? It's December! He's going from Nigeria to Amsterdam to Detroit without a coat? With a one-way ticket? Oh, do you think he's going to Detroit to start a better life? What do you think he's going there? Because he heard there's lots of jobs? You know what, intelligence community? Meet me at camera three. All right, I know you guys are busy. Those 300 million Americans can't wiretap themselves, but remember something. This guy, Richard Reed, the shoe bomber, he paid cash, he flew one way, he had no luggage from a European capital and tried to blow up a plane with PETN explosives hidden in his shoes 8 years ago. So now, 8 years later, the Lex Luthor-like geniuses of Al-Qaeda decided,
I got an idea. This time, why don't we have a guy pay cash and fly one way, no luggage from a European capital with the PET and explosives hidden under his... In 8 years, all they did was move the explosive up whatever the inseam measurement is, changing nothing else about the modus operandi. I realize security will never be 100%. We don't expect you to catch everything, but we do expect you to catch the exact same thing. At least we caught the guy. 8 years ago, we depended on passengers to subdue plane terrorists. At least we've come a long way since then.
The suspect, identified as Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalib, was tackled by passengers and apprehended.
So in 8 years, we've had two wars to overthrow terror-supporting regimes, trillions of dollars, thousands of lives, and our best defense against terrorism continues to be alert passenger tackles guy trying to light his...
Now, that was New World Notes, available from newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Now, let's shift from a laughably inept false flag attack, if there is anything laughable about this genre, to a deadly serious attack, one which has not yet, to my mind, been conclusively revealed as a false flag, the so-called 7/7 bombings on July the 7th. But which nevertheless exhibit a number of obvious telltale signs, such as motive in terms of timing, inconsistencies in the provided explanation, and remarkable coincidences such as the simultaneous scheduling of an identical terror exercise. Most of the material in this last section of the show is drawn again from BCFM, Bristol Community Local Radio. This is their Drive Time program, hosted by Tony Gosling, who featured in our show on Bilderberg.
Almost 5 years ago, on the 7th of July 2005, three explosions on the London Underground and one on a bus claimed 56 lives. The attacks shocked the nation in the middle of the G8 summit at Gleneagles, and all talk of dealing with the problems of mounting debt made way with an attack that swept away all doubts about the terror threat to Britain. The terror threat was now real. But this is unfinished business. Many unanswered questions remain, and as time has passed, evidence has trickled out that entirely contradicts some of the Home Office and police version of events that day. In the absence of a public inquiry, which has been blocked by successive Attorney Generals and Prime Ministers, in the next hour we'll do our own inquiry into the 7/7 London bombings. One young man living here in Bristol, who just missed out on a job offer for the government's surveillance service, GCHQ, in Cheltenham, because he was away from home, was immediately suspicious about the attacks. Adrian Connock immediately set about compiling what is arguably the most comprehensive website documenting all the news articles and interviews circulating in the aftermath of the attacks. And he joins me now. Hello, Adrian, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hi, Tony. Glad to be here.
Now, first of all, can you remind us, where did the three attacks take place?
That would be Aldgate, Edgware Road, and the number 30 bus going to Houston.
Who were the actual... What are the names of the alleged bombers?
Shehzad Tanweer, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan, Hasib Hussein, and Jermaine Lindsay.
And what about your film, Mind the Gap? Because you made this roughly how long after the attacks?
It's almost a year afterwards.
What really prompted you to do it?
No one else was really doing it, so I took it upon myself to make the film. I'd never made a film before, but I turned out a script and got David Shaler involved and produced it quite easily, really. A lot of people wanted to help me. They saw it as an opportunity to put out views that hadn't been put out on the mainstream.
That's the introduction to the show. I condensed an hour's show into about 10 minutes, so here's some more thoughts from Martin Summers, a UK economist.
Now, Martin, there is a possibility here that this is a false flag attack. What might be a potential motive for a false flag attack in the London bombings case?
Well, as the contributors have pointed out, this is the only major terrorist attack that's taken place. And if no terrorist attacks take place, people might start to question whether there is a terrorist threat or there isn't a terrorist threat. I think we need to look back to the 1980s when a lot of these jihadist groups were founded with the help of the Western security services. There's no doubt about that. That's a matter of historical record. MI6, the CIA, in collaboration with Mossad in the background, set up an awful lot of jihadists. jihadi terrorist groups to fight in Afghanistan. Now, you could see this as potentially blowback. We've created a Frankenstein's monster and it's now out of our control. But of course, many people around the world outside of middle-class England, they think, actually, you may still be in control of these terrorist groups and that you're actually creating these kind of events. For example, we saw the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980. Italian parliamentary inquiry has definitely shown that that was carried out by their own security forces in order to create a strategia di tensione, a creation of tension, a creation of fear, so that certain political goals can be fulfilled. Now, I'm not saying that that's what did happen on 7/7, but it's a perfectly logical thing to ask, is this what's going on? And that's what an inquiry might help to uncover.
Well, one of the things that definitely mitigates against that is the suicide videos, Adrian. What about those?
Well, the one of Khan, the lip sync, is out. And, of course, these videos just come from unknown providence. We don't really know the source. They're released on Al Jazeera. They haven't been scrutinised in any kind of court. None of the evidence, in fact, against the men has actually been scrutinised in a court. And so it is possible these videos were made under some other pretense. And people should remember that the actual bombings in London are not mentioned in either video by Khan or Tanweer. So, for me, I don't think they would be admissible in a court of law as conclusive evidence.
Can I just make the further point that nobody's suggesting here that these chaps might not have been genuine jihadi terrorists? They may or may not have been. But the way false flag terrorism works is that you have patsies who are put in the frame to look as if they did it, but in actual fact, the actual bombing is done by somebody else. So we had the 19 terrorists who supposedly hijacked planes on September the 11th, and they crashed the planes into the buildings. But the suggestion is, because nanothermite has been found in the rubble by investigators from Copenhagen University, that the so-called 19 hijackers and the planes are a diversion from the actual bombing of the three buildings that went down on September the 11th, including the Building 7. Now, because we're living in a universe where false flag terrorism is going on. In Turkey, the police have arrested a lot of their top generals for false flag terrorist offences. It's legitimate, and certainly within the Muslim community, as you well know, Tony, questions are being asked about whether this is a false flag terrorist event of a kind which is very common in Pakistan, where many Muslims come from. Middle England very rarely gets bombed, so they always take the straightforward explanation of what which they're presented with. Other parts of the world get bombed all the time, and they get a much more sophisticated analysis of what might be happening.
Right, let's go back to 2005 and to the day itself. The Guardian's Mark Honingsbaum rushed straight down to the scene of the Edgware Road underground blast and filed this audio report for the Guardian website, where he talks about the bomb being under the train and the floor tiles having been lifted up.
This is Mark Honigsbaum reporting from the London Hilton Hotel opposite Edgware Road station, where we believe there was an explosion this morning under the carriage of a train. I've been speaking to survivors all morning. People were evacuated, first of all, to Marks and Spencer's beside the underground, and then across the road to the London Hilton, where there are some people in very, very bad injuries. There was a woman who got cuts and burns to her face and is being wrapped from head to neck in bandages. There's people with blood cuts. But, I mean, the main thing is people are extremely shook up still. What seems to have happened is that sometime around 9:30 this morning, passengers in a train from Edgware Road travelling to Paddington, they'd just left Edgware Road station when suddenly they felt they had a massive explosion. And some passengers described how the tiles, the covers on the floor of the train suddenly flew up, raised up, and the next thing they know, there was another almighty crash, which they now believe was a train travelling in the opposite direction, hitting their train, which had been derailed by this explosion.
That was Guardian's Mark Honingsbaum reporting on the 7th of July 2005 itself from the site of the attack at the Edgware Road tube bomb. Now, he actually does say there that the bomb was underneath the train, and yet in the article which actually appeared in the next day's Guardian, he was saying that the bomb was inside the train. And I actually phoned up Mark Honingsbaum about 2-3 weeks after the attacks and asked him why there was a discrepancy. And he said to me, "Well, Tony, all I can say is, not everything I submit in copy ends up in the next day's newspaper."
The next clip is taken from the BBC 5 Drive radio programme from the day itself, July 7th, 2005. What I find particularly interesting about this clip is not only the revelations by Peter Power, who's ex-Scotland Yard, now running an independent terror analysis company, but the fact that he volunteers them without being asked.
Let's talk to Peter Power, a former senior officer from Scotland Yard, now managing director of Visor Consultants, that company which really deals in management of crises. Peter, I mean, what can we do as a city? What can we do as a people? How are we supposed to behave in future? You can't stop these kind of things, can you?
Well, you can reduce the amount of opportunity. Really, we should be thinking about taking some reasonable steps against unreasonable people. I have to say that what Mike Granite said there about being a wake-up call, I'm sorry I don't agree with that. We've had wake-up calls. If this is another wake-up call, something wrong. The alarm's been ringing for many years. People have been saying, get ready for this, it's going to happen, from the Prime Minister downwards. The other thing we should be thinking about is really looking at what you were just talking about. What should we be doing? Certainly when I was at Scotland Yard, and it wasn't all that long ago, we were having events like this probably every week at the height of the IRA campaign. Big difference then, of course, mostly, not always, we had enough warning. Mm. Although that was a little bit circumspect in some cases. But now we're dealing with people who simply want to have mass casualties. They want no dialogue, no warning. They don't want an agenda and so on. Things are a little bit different.
Well, indeed. And that's why it's so difficult. So what do we do? You can't... I mean, some people just say, look, the best thing to do is just carry on as you were, because you can't let bombers subjugate you. You can't allow your life to be destroyed by them. I mean, how do you effectively provide security on an underground system?
Well, you're quite right. Security at very best is proportionate. It'll never, ever be absolute. The thing that concerns me is that what are we doing for the thousands of men and women actually who are in London working? And I say that because at 9:30 this morning we were actually running an exercise for over a company of 1,000 people in London based on simultaneous bombs going off precisely at the railway stations that happened this morning. So I still have the hairs on the back of my neck standing upright.
So you get this quite straight. You were running an exercise to see how you would cope with this, and it happened while you were running the exercise.
Precisely. And it was about 9:30 this morning. We planned this for a company, and for obvious reasons I don't want to reveal their name, but they're listening and they'll know it. We had a room for the crisis managers for the first time they met. And so within 5 minutes we made a pretty rapid decision. This is the real one. And so we went through the correct drills of activating crisis management procedures to jump from slow time to quick time thinking, yeah, and so on.
Well, that's all very good, slow time to quick time thinking and crisis management procedures. But, you know, if you've just been blown up by a bomb on a train, none of that helps very much. I mean, you know,
so very interesting that there should be anti-terrorist exercises on the day. Very interesting that they should involve exactly the same stations as the bombings. I am reminded of the fact that on September 11th, 2001, there were more anti-terrorist exercises going on than on any other day before or since. And several of these exercises involved the hijacking of planes. Let me paint an alternative picture, which is that 4 Muslims had been recruited by MI5 and told that they were taking part in an anti-terror exercise. They boarded underground trains and a bus carrying what they believed to be fake bombs. Now, either they were real bombs or other bombs were in place, thus allowing an easy switch of responsibility to the patsies who had provided an explanation for what went on. And of course it's not just bombs. If we look at history's lone gunman, for example the case of JFK, Oswald did have connections to the national security state which were not investigated at the time. And Peter Power, his ex-Scotland Yard, was running this terror exercise, and I don't think even to this day he has admitted for whom he was running that exercise, which is obviously relevant, so any real investigation would be making inquiries on this point. And if commercial secrecy or any other interest were deemed more important than getting to the bottom of what happened, I would suggest to you that that's not a real investigation. Now, let's have another clip. This is him speaking on live television on July the 7th, the day of the bombings.
Issue. Today we were running an exercise for a company, bearing in mind I'm now in the private sector,
And we sat everybody down in the city, 1,000 people involved in the whole organisation, but the crisis team. And the most peculiar thing was we based our scenario on the simultaneous attacks on the Underground and Mainline station. So we had to suddenly switch an exercise from fictional to real. And one of the first things is get that bureau number. When you have a list of people missing, tell them. And so it took a long time.
Just to get this right, you were actually working today on an exercise that envisioned virtually this scenario.
Almost precisely. I was up until 2 o'clock this morning because it's our job. My own company, Visor Consultants, we specialise in helping people to get their crisis management response. How do you jump from slow time thinking to quick time doing? And we chose a scenario with their assistance which is based on a terrorist attack because they're very close to a property occupied by Jewish businessmen. They're in the city and there are more American banks in the city than there are in the whole of New York. A logical thing to do. And
how extraordinary today must feel for you as it unfolds.
Extraordinary indeed. Let us work towards a day when such gruesome and cynical events can be relegated to the pages of history books. If you're involved in national security forces, I hope this show has helped you to do some reflection on what security you're actually providing to whom, on whose interests you're serving. As a commander and instigator of such events, I suggest that their days are numbered, because ordinary people and those you regard as your underlings are increasingly wising up to what is going on. If you're involved as a functionary, I hope you will reflect on possible dangers of collaborating with such plots, the fact that they regularly consume patsies and discard them, whether in bombs, hit-and-run accidents or however, when no longer needed. If you're involved in the media, I hope this show will give you food for thought about the veracity of the so-called war on terror and the value or otherwise of a system in which unaccountable editors can change the reporting made by journalists who were there on the spot. If you are a member of the public but possessed of a digital camera or other recording devices, I hope, should you ever be caught up in such an event, that you will have your wits about you and record what you personally saw, heard, felt, and not make the mistake of trusting authorities with your evidence, but communicate it directly to your peers, your brothers and sisters, the citizens of the world. If you're interested in hearing more of the media used to make this show, the originals are available for download at unwelcomeguests.net/533. The show has a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome for anyone interested in giving feedback on the show, suggesting ideas, or otherwise making a contribution to future episodes. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Try and think big and keep giving all you can.